On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all know the story, delivered in grade school textbooks across the country, of how the universe began. The Big Bang, 14 billion years ago, space and time and everything exploding into being in a flash and still exploding as celestial bodies race apart across the cosmos. Well, maybe so. But the Big Bang theory has taken its lumps in recent years. Now, renegade physicists are making a new case that it didn't all start in an instant, that there is no beginning and no end. And those are fighting words in the halls of science. Up next on Point, the big rumble over the Big Bang. Joining me first today from Cambridge, England, is mathematical physics professor at Cambridge University, Neil Turok. He's co-author with Princeton University professor of physics and astrophysical sciences Paul Steinhardt of the new book, Endless Universe, Beyond the Big Bang. Neil Turok, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We have a primary school, grade school textbook understanding of the Big Bang. You say it's not exactly got it right. That's a big challenge to the way most Americans and most kids around the world are taught. So what's the challenge you're raising?
I think the challenge we're raising is that the usual picture of the Big Bang is based on an assumption, which is that time, space, matter, energy, everything began at the Big Bang. And that assumption was made in the 60s when people first got the first strong observational evidence that a Big Bang happened. But it's really just an assumption. And our point of view has come out of new developments in physics, which are enabling us to describe the behavior of matter in very extreme conditions, such as we're present around the bang. And what we're seeing is that the Big Bang doesn't have to be the beginning of time. It's perfectly possible that the Big Bang was just a violent event in a pre-existing universe. And so our most simple point is that there are two possibilities. Either time began at the Big Bang or it didn't. And both of them are very interesting to explore. And so far, only the idea that time began at the Big Bang has been explored seriously.
Your model, and the alternative model, is a kind of a cyclical or cyclic model that this Big Bang perhaps was just one of many?
Exactly. And so this picture emerged out of a new understanding of the laws of physics, which is called M-theory. And it's a rather technical subject. It involves the most sophisticated mathematics we have. But according to this picture, the world may be comprised of two objects called brains, which are...
That's B-R-A-N-E, like
exactly,
as in membrane, sort of. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, short of membranes. Mm-hmm. And so the picture is that we live in a three-dimensional world, just the height, width, and length of ordinary space, but separated from our dimensions by a very tiny distance are another three dimensions. And so the whole world is four-dimensional in this picture. And these two sets of dimensions can actually collide with each other. And what we discovered is if they do collide, then something like a Big Bang happens. But the density of matter and the size of the universe is not zero at that point. It's as if two objects clash together, and this clash is what releases radiation, which fills space.
So does your view depend on us believing or proving that there is a parallel universe, a kind of shadow world out there? And if so, what's the evidence of that?
The evidence at this point is mainly mathematical, that when one tries to make a unified theory of all the laws of physics, including gravity, particle physics, and everything else we know about the world, then for reasons simply of logical consistency and getting the mathematics to give sensible answers, we find ourselves having to postulate that there are extra dimensions of space. So, funnily enough, this is actually the simplest theory of fundamental physics we have, that there are these extra dimensions.
Hmm. So you've got a cyclical model here. These great bodies collide. A Big Bang occurs. You're not saying that the Big Bang didn't happen. You're just saying it would have been perhaps one of many.
Exactly.
And this, as opposed to what's called the cyclic model, as opposed to the inflationary model, the author of that, Alan Guth, we'll speak with in a few minutes. But remind us of that. The Big Bang is sort of comes part and parcel with inflation theory.
Yes, it does. Well, you see, once you take the point of view that the Big Bang was the beginning of time, it turns out it's very difficult to explain the properties of the universe we see today. It's very large, it's very uniform and smooth, whereas if everything springs out of a point, suddenly, well, mm-hmm. the first thing you have to explain how that's possible. The second thing you have to explain why it sprang out of the point so smooth and uniform. Whereas in our picture of these two very large objects which clash, the universe is smooth because it was smooth before the bang. And in fact, the reason it was smooth before the bang is because of the dark energy which was present in the universe and which we actually observe today.
Dark energy is getting a lot of attention lately. Describe for us what that is. Is dark energy explains why the racing apart of celestial bodies, why the velocity of that continues to increase, if I got that right?
Exactly. So this was discovered within the last decade, and it's a huge surprise for the standard picture. And in fact, it's the main reason which initially motivated us to reconsider the standard picture. So in the standard picture, everything springs into existence 14 billion years ago mm-hmm. at huge density and flying apart extremely rapidly, okay, for unexplained reasons. It's just an assumption. Mm-hmm. Secondly, as we wait and the universe thins out, the matter density falls, everything becomes widely separated, what was discovered is that sort of underneath this density of matter, there's dark energy in an amount which is very, very hard to understand. So the dark energy today is taking over the universe, but just because everything else is diluting away to nothing. And what the dark energy does is it has a repulsive gravitational field. It's really the opposite of all the matter we're used to. Usually gravity causes things mm-hmm. to clump mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. Dark energy causes them to fly apart. And so within the last decade, astronomers have discovered that in the recent past of the universe, this dark energy has begun to overwhelm all the matter, causing everything to fly apart increasingly rapidly. And if we follow it to our future, the future of the universe is apparently dominated by dark energy. Everything else will be diluted away to negligible levels.
So flying apart further and further, perhaps faster and faster. We're going to dig into all of this, but you say in broad stroke that your cyclical model, where perhaps there's Big Bang after Big Bang, and the inflationary model, which is this, which goes with the single Big Bang theory that we've lived with for so long, that they have very different implications when it comes to what happened before the 1 second mark of existence and what will occur in the future. How so?
Exactly. So within our theory, we started really by thinking about this dark energy. What's the significance of this dark energy? In the standard picture, it just takes over the universe and it will be on top of everything forever. The future, in the standard picture, our future is a universe dominated by dark energy.
So what? What does that mean to me?
There's no future. Nothing happens in the future. It's a rather strange picture.
You mean life, matter, everything goes away?
Everything will die out. The stars will all die out. The galaxies will fly apart so fast that we won't see any galaxies in the future.
So you paint the Big Bang as kind of nihilistic. What's your cyclical vision?
Well, we started thinking, is there another way? Is it possible that this dark energy doesn't have to be there forever? And what we realized is that within the context of this M theory picture, the dark energy is really the energy stored between these two brains. And what can happen is that that it's like a spring. If you pull the brains apart, that energy is the dark energy. And what happens is that same energy can be responsible for the two brains being pulled back together so they collide. And another way of saying that is in our model, the dark energy decays in the future. It won't last forever.
Like a rubber band pulled to its furthest extent and then coming back?
Exactly.
And so worlds are born again?
Exactly. So the decay of the dark energy we see today will cause the next Big Bang. And so once we realized that this can happen, we thought, well, maybe it can happen over and over again. You have a bang followed by radiation and matter being released, followed by dark energy taking over, then the dark energy decays, and there's the next bang, and there's more matter and radiation, and so on.
So that puts you in the position of the sunny guy who says, it doesn't all go away, we've got life after life after life.
Absolutely.
We're talking this hour about a new challenge to the Big Bang theory and scientists in a big fight over the origins of the universe, of everything, really. We've been joined from Cambridge, England, University there, by Neil Turok, physicist and co-author of the new book with Paul Steinhardt at Princeton, Endless Universe Beyond the Big Bang. And you've got a sense of what he's describing here, though there's much more to understand. We're joined as well right now. With me in the studio is Alan Guth, professor of physics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, author of The Inflationary Universe, The Quest for a New Theory of Cosmic Origins. Some have called him the father of the inflationary theory that backs up the Big Bang, and he and Neil Turok have gone nose to nose before on exactly this subject. Alan Guth, thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Now, we understand we're in the company of great scientists and physicists here, but this is hot stuff. You pulled out a slide of a monkey at a big conference on this debate, and everybody was shocked and stunned, thinking, "Oh, are you calling Neil and Paul apes in their new concept?" But there's a huge debate at the heart of this. How do you see the idea that Neil Turok and Paul Steinhardt are putting on the table here?
Okay. First of all, I do unfortunately have to say that the controversy is a little bit more complicated than has been presented.
We have
so
no
far.
Doubt of this. Help us out.
Right. So in particular, so far it's been made to sound, I think for purposes of simplifying things, that until the cyclic model, all scientists had believed that the Big Bang was the origin of time itself. That idea is certainly part of the classic theory of the Big Bang.
Yes.
But it's an idea which I think most cosmologists have not taken seriously in quite a while. That is the idea that there's something that happened before what we call the Big Bang has been around for a fair number of years.
So and in this more sophisticated view,
in various ways by various cosmologists.
Then what did begin at the Big Bang in this more sophisticated view? If not time, then what?
What I would regard as the conventional version of inflation, of the inflationary theory, the Big Bang was also not in that theory the origin of everything, but rather one had a very long period of this exponential expansion of the universe, which is what inflation means. Mm-hmm. And at different points, different pieces of this inflating universe had stopped inflating and become what I sometimes call pocket universes.
But did it not in this more sophisticated version, the inflationary theory, did it not begin from, this tiny, super dense matter exploding out? If it's been inflating, sort of endlessly for a long time, was there no Big Bang point in your perspective, your view?
That we don't know. But the what we call the Big Bang was almost certainly not the actual origin of time in either of the theories that we're talking about.
So what's the difference then between yours and Neil and Paul's?
The main difference, I think, is the answer to the question of what is it that made the universe large and smoothed everything out. In Neil's and Paul's theory, the universe became large and got smoothed out during the previous cycle because it's a cyclic model. The inflationary version of cosmology is not cyclic. Maybe that's another key difference between the two.
It's a one-time event.
Well, it's not quite a one-time event either, but it's not cyclic. It goes on literally forever with new universes being created in other places. But our region of space-time would not undergo cyclic evolution in the inflationary model. What Paul said is what Neil said is true. The inflationary prediction is that our region of the universe would become ultimately empty and void. But meanwhile, other universes would sprout out in other places in this multiverse.
So here are two perspectives. And when you look at the cyclic version as a kind of author and torchbearer for the inflationary view, what do you see as the problems in the cyclic view that Neil's putting forward?
Right. I think the biggest problem is that the bounce itself is very difficult to describe.
The what itself?
The bounce, bouncing off of these two brains with each other, the collision of the two brains.
I'm still having trouble with brains, and I bet some of our listeners are as well. B-R-A-N-E. How do you
Correct.
Define what a brain is? Maybe it's wrong to ask. I don't know if you even believe they exist.
No, I do believe they exist. And it's short for membrane. That's the important thing to mm-hmm. recognize. And if you want
so
to keep
like
that
the skin
in mind,
of the cosmos
okay.
or something?
Well, the point is that these theories that we're using based on string theory imply that there are more dimensions to space than what we see. So one version of it, which is the version that Neil and Paul are using, is a version where we live on a three-dimensional membrane. Let me call it a membrane mm-hmm. and not a brain to mm-hmm. avoid confusion. We live on a three-dimensional membrane that's floating in a higher dimensional space. And there's another three-dimensional membrane nearby, and we are colliding with it cyclically, according to their theory.
All right. And you have a problem with that?
The problem is that the collision between these brains is something which is very difficult to describe mathematically. And in particular, there really does not yet exist a completely mathematically well-defined description of this collision.
Neil, is it so fanciful or impossible to define mathematically that you've had to take a kind of leap of faith to present it?
Yes, it's a hypothesis. I think I agree with Alan that it's not yet fully described. I would say we've provided bits of evidence, and I would say a lot of evidence that it does work, that when two brains collide, they bounce off each other. The alternative picture would be when they collide, that's the end of time. And so I think our hypothesis is the simplest one, and I would say there's quite a lot of evidence that they do bounce off each other. But this is a new model, and we are still very actively developing the mathematics which is required to describe this bounce. Just to give you an idea how difficult this is, you not only want to describe how the bang happened and how radiation was produced. We think we know how to do that. You have to describe how anything which existed on the brains, for example, a black hole and a galaxy, you have to describe how that survives the bounce and passes through the bounce. So in a sense, what the problem we're working on now, and we're about to put a new paper out about it, is in fact how black holes can go through the bang. So it's extremely technical and difficult work, and it may well be we hit a roadblock. The mathematics tells us this is not possible, and I think then we'll have to go back to the old picture that the initial singularity in the universe was the beginning of time.
The bounce of membranes in the cosmos, this is a new kind of metaphor and image for generations now raised with that, science textbook image of some giant flash in the darkness. I want to begin to bring our listeners in here. Charlie is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
This question is for Neil. In your cyclical model of the universe, is there any evidence that the universe is created the same exact way as it was before, or has it changed slightly, or is it just completely random? The new universe is created.
In other words, is it the sort of the same deal every time out, or is it different every time? Neil?
Yeah, I think one would say the broad properties would be the same each time. This is not something we're certain of because we've only studied simplified aspects of the model. So, for example, in the simplest version of the model, the dark energy would come out exactly the same as it was before. The average density of matter, the average density of radiation, they would be the same. But if you look at the fluctuations in the universe, the variations in the density, like galaxies, planets, people, these are created by quantum variations in the decay of the dark energy before the bang. And those quantum variations are random each time over. So new people, new planets, new galaxies would form each time.
So you and I can't count on having this conversation again in a trillion years.
Unfortunately not.
But when you say new people, do you really mean that? Or, I mean, anything even like humans? Or is there enough quantum variation that life, even if there were life, would be utterly different on the other side of another Big Bang?
I think we just don't understand the conditions necessary for the evolution of life like ours, nor whether it's possible to have other forms of life. So I think at this point we really can't say.
Alan Guth, you guys are playing nice today, but does this sound like gobbledygook to you as a physicist? You've been very critical of this whole theory.
No, to be honest, I mean, even though I've been critical of the theory, it does not sound like gobbledygook, no. What Neil is proposing is a possible theory. It does have the incomplete features that Neil spoke about. And
the missing
really
math around the bounce
of
membranes.
The missing math around the bounce, and that's crucial. The truth of the matter is that we had theories of bouncing universes back in the 1930s, and those theories just died because nobody ever figured out the mathematics to describe those bounces successfully. And this theory may die the same way, which is the possible roadblock that Neil himself mentioned. I regard the motivation of this theory as pretty much lacking. It's based on a philosophy.
The motivation is lacking. That sounds like in-house talk. What do you mean by that? You don't know why Neil and Paul are bothering with it, you mean?
That's right. Well, I'm exaggerating. I think it makes sense for somebody to bother with it. I think it's typical for the authors of a theory to be more enthusiastic about that theory than other people are from the outside,
right.
Of course. And I think this is no exception to that general rule. So I don't really see any problems that this particular version of cosmology would solve that were not already solved by inflation.
Neil, let me ask you, when we go to Alan Guth in the first instance asking
you about... I will disagree with that.
I have no doubt of that. let me put the question in this context, though. You know, when I first turned to Alan Guth with my questions about the Big Bang, and here I'm operating from the same kind of, you know, grade school Big Bang education as most other Americans, and he immediately backed away from that as the beginning of space and time and said, no, you know, inflationary theory has supplanted that. It's more complicated than that. Do you see it that way, Neil, or?
No, I don't. I think his picture of eternal inflation is really on very shaky mathematical ground. So I agree that we have work to do to show that the bounce is possible. But I think he certainly has a lot of work to do to show that this eternal inflation picture makes sense. I mean, in fact, his recent papers point to various conceptual difficulties with that picture, that it's not clear that the concept of eternal inflation without any beginning really makes sense, nor is it clear that the typical patch of universe emerging from eternal inflation is smooth and uniform like what we see. There may be lots of regions that are rather wild and chaotic. No, I don't buy the eternal inflation picture.
And I'll go to Alan Guth on that, but let me ask you this first. This is a very different paradigm you're describing. Now, we live a long way from the realm of where you and Alan and other physicists, astrophysicists, do your work. But these metaphors and their implications do filter down to our assumptions about how we live in the world. If there's a shift here, if we get off of the inflationary Big Bang bicycle and get on to yours, how does it change the way humans look at the world? How might it change the way, I don't know, science and technology develop in the next century or two?
I think it's of enormous significance because within the standard picture where you assume that space and time spring into existence, And I think even Alan will agree there had to be a beginning in the inflationary picture of some sort. That's just required. If you have such a picture and you can't really understand the beginning, then I think you're faced with a huge dilemma. Why did the laws of physics turn out the way they did? In string theory, as we've mentioned, there are these extra dimensions. And it turns out the size and the shape of the extra dimensions are exactly what determines all of the physical laws. So when you ask how did the laws turn out the way they did, you have to go back to the Big Bang to understand what happened at the Big Bang in order to understand why the universe turned out the way it is. And I think as long as we stick to the standard picture, we won't solve those problems, nor will we understand the dark energy. And that's the big disagreement I have about Alan. I think in our model with the cycles, we can understand why the dark energy is so small today. And that's because it has relaxed to a very small value over very long periods of time, many cycles of evolution.
We get it to the extent we get it, and that's critical in your realm. What about in the everyday realm? As sort of civilians understand science or see its fruits, do they change? Do the fruits of science change if this presumption, basic assumptions change?
Yes, I think the goals of science for the last century at least and several centuries have been to understand the fundamental laws of nature using as precise theories as we can, and those are usually based on mathematics. The standard picture has sort of reached a logical endpoint. There's a crisis within the subject. People talk about a landscape of possibilities using the anthropic principle.
That is what?
The anthropic principle is the idea that the universe is inherently random, and this has emerged from the eternal inflationary picture, that the universe is inherently random, and the reason we see the world around us as it is because it has to be that way to allow us to exist, to allow life to exist.
So puts us right
in the center of the cosmos. So our model is quite different. It's trying to say, no, let's try and find a set of laws of physics which actually govern everything with themselves, and we're more or less incidental to it. We're, of course, an outcome of those laws, but we're not the primary determining factor.
Alan Guth, do you feel your quadrant or more of the debate in physics in crisis, the inflationary theory and the Big Bang theory in crisis?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, there's such tremendous uncertainty. Neil was absolutely right when he said that this dark energy was totally unexpected. There are, in fact, a few people who did expect it, but I certainly was not one of them. I think most of the community was thrown for a loop by the discovery of dark energy, and we're still trying to figure out how that fits into the broader picture.
And again, we know it's there because the rate, the velocity of things flying apart is increasing.
Correct.
That's the fundamental reason.
That's the fundamental observation.
It's not constant.
Faster today than it was 5 billion years ago.
And does that throw your work into a cocked hat? Or, you know, why do you still, does dark energy sort of knock inflationary theory out of the box or just puts
a
new wrinkle?
No, actually, in a way, quite the contrary. Dark energy makes inflation fit the observations much better than it did before. One of the predictions of inflation is the total mass density of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 years ago, the astronomers told us that we were off by about a factor of 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
With the addition of the dark energy, now the inflationary prediction is right on the button. So in terms of fitting observations, the dark energy was a big success for inflation. But in terms of anybody feeling that we have an ultimate understanding of the fundamental laws of physics that underlie this, the dark energy is a big knuckleball.
Let's get a call from Ryan in Lowell, Massachusetts. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have, first of all, an observation, and then second of all, a question. From the observation standpoint, I have to say that it's really great to hear that these guys are arguing about this stuff, because the way I see it, major advances in science have always been a challenge to existing preconceived notions of how the world is.
Great. So bring it on. Let's have the big conversation and see what we learn. Yep.
Exactly. So my question is for Neil. It seems as if a lot of this sort of rebound or bouncing brains theory has to do with dark energy. As I see it, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, but as I see it, it requires dark energy to kind of change its polarity almost and turn from an oppositional force into an attractional force, or maybe it decays in such a way that gravity. Is there any evidence that shows that that's actually happening, or how does that particular transition take place in this model?
Ryan, let us pick it up. Neil, how about it? We think we understand the energy, the evidence of dark energy in the increasing velocity of things flying apart, but you're saying it's going to spring back. Ryan wants evidence.
There isn't evidence at the moment. according to the theory, it would only start to spring back many billions of years in the future. Okay, but the way in which it springs back is actually very simple. Imagine you have a spring and you stretch it to its limit. And we say in physics that's when it has a lot of potential energy. but it doesn't have any energy of motion. As the spring pulls itself back, that energy gets converted into kinetic energy, energy of motion, and that's when the two objects collide. And so in our model, the dark energy has this feature, that it really is a potential energy like the energy in a spring, and when the spring contracts again, it'll turn into kinetic energy, and that's what causes the clash of the brains and drives the next bang.
But with that theory, without evidence, I mean, how do we know that you're not just shining us on or in love with your with a dream you had, let's say?
I think the people sometimes don't understand why we develop these theories. In my view,
I mean it with respect, but you know.
No, it's a good question. I have to say that belief is not a major factor, at least for me.
Yeah.
I view this as an intellectual exercise to explore the fascinating possibility that the Big Bang is a describable physical event and not the beginning of time, okay? Mm. So we try to make the most consistent, logical, complete mathematical model we can, mm-hmm. and we try to match it with the real world. Now, what you then get out of it is some predictions. And so, for example, one of the wonderful things is that there actually are observations which are possible, which may distinguish between the inflationary model that Alan was advocating mm-hmm. and this other model.
Is advocating, I believe. Present tense.
Is advocating. Yes. Very well, too. and let me also add that the role of these models is really very helpful in driving new observations. I believe very firmly that we only really know things about the universe once we've made the observations and tested these theories.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are critical.
Let me test that assertion with Alan yeah. Guth. Alan Guth, so is this radical departure from what we've understood, is it driving a useful debate or is it just driving you crazy? Do you see it as a diversion?
No, I think it is driving a useful debate. The role of string theory in cosmology is a new area, and there are many different models of how string theory can influence cosmology or models of cosmology based on string theory. What Neil is describing is one of those models. There are also many other models which are much more consistent with the conventional picture of inflation that has been around for 20 or more years now.
I want to bring one more voice into this conversation. From New York City, Jana Levin joins us. She's a professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College. She's the author of How the Universe Got Its Spots, Diary of a Finite Time in a Finite Space. Jana Levin, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So here we are, you know, the civilians sitting in the bleachers watching these astrophysics gladiators down in the ring. And on the one hand, we can barely follow. On the other, you know, it's everything to do with the universe we live in. Is this a good debate, Jana? Are we going somewhere here? People are saying this is the best of times and the worst of times in physics. We're trying to figure it out from the cheap seats. How do you see this debate?
Well, I think it's always interesting to explore alternatives. And what people should realize is that inflation was once that daring idea. It was the new idea that was on the table to explain some really profound issues about the early universe. And what happened with inflation, as I'm sure Alan will attest, is people took to the idea in droves. Everyone immediately recognized the significance of this idea. It happened very fast.
Yeah.
I think there's a little more resistance to the cyclic model, but maybe that's because of the successes so far of inflation. Yet we do know that there are fundamental things about the early universe and the Big Bang that we don't understand. And as they were both describing, string theory or M theory or these other models of fundamental physics are going to be important in terms of formulating that early universe picture, but they're not complete yet. So it might turn out that inflation is completely filled out and we have exactly an ability to recognize what the source of inflation is in these stringy models or these M-theory models, or it might turn out that there's some other alternative such as a cyclic model or something really quite different.
Jana, let me ask you to test just how antediluvian I may be. I mean, Alan suggests that the Big Bang is kind of passé, that the inflation preceded it, time preceded it, things were inflating before it, or, I mean, sort of, is a Big Bang still a useful metaphor here itself?
Well, I think it's fair to say that for a long time, people have recognized that that might be a silly picture. First there was nothing, and then there was something. But I think everyone here agrees that we don't really know what happened there. If there was if not an origin to time, some very interesting event that led to what we know to be a hot, high-energy, dense state out of which the universe began to expand. That is the mystery terrain, and that's why this is an interesting discussion, because that's how we get to an answer.
Let me ask you another layman's question, if I may. Why these days, every time we talk about, you know, what's really going on, why do parallel universes always come into it, shadow worlds? It's got something to do with string theory, but, it, you know, to a layman it sounds kind of suspect, like you can't see it, you can't feel it, but just trust us, it must be out there. Why is that always on the table?
Sure. I wouldn't say it's always on the table. What string theory invokes, which is something that we've learned to live with, is the idea of extra dimensions, that the universe might not be simply three spatial dimensions and one dimension of time. There might be extra spatial dimensions out there. And because that's one of the things that's required to make the theory mathematically consistent, we've learned to kind of live with it, and not just live with it, but embrace it and begin to pursue the exciting implications of it. Maybe this isn't a handicap. Maybe this is something that will prove to be valuable in understanding the origin of the universe.
Let's take a call from New Haven, Connecticut. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you know? What do you see?
Okay. My question regards something which one of your guests just started to address a minute ago, and I wanted to go back to it. I'm thinking that they've been talking a lot about the mathematical predictions, the mathematical possibilities of these theories, and I'm worried that within any theory that's string theory-based, and I think Professor Sheldon Glashow would probably agree with me on this, that testability becomes an issue. And I'm wondering specifically what tests are there that can now or in the future could possibly distinguish between this the cyclical model, between the cyclical model and then the inflationary model.
Okay, Neil Turok in Cambridge, England, is there, you know, now or someday going to be a test which will decide this?
Yes, remarkably enough, there is. And the test is the detection of gravitational waves emerging from the very early universe, an inevitable side effect of inflation, which is this sort of super rapid period of expansion, which then caused the expansion of everything else, of the radiation matter after the Big Bang. That period inevitably generates gravitational waves. And so the whole universe should be filled with a sea of background gravitational waves oscillating space and time everywhere. And next year, a satellite will be launched called the Planck satellite, the European Space Agency. It'll map the radiation from the Big Bang, and it's quite possible that it will see evidence of these gravitational waves. They're within the limits of its capability. And then over the next 10 years, 20 years, there'll be future satellites that'll go out directly looking for these gravitational waves. If they are seen, I think this will be fantastic confirmation of Alan's picture, and it will show that our picture is wrong, because right now in our picture, we don't see how to produce these kinds of gravitational waves. In fact, so I would say differently, if they're not found, this would be evidence in favor of our picture.
Alan Guth, what about it? Do you expect a moment of truth here coming up, a kind of evidence moment?
Well, it's not quite as clear-cut as Neil made it sound, as I'm sure Neil really knows, because there are inflationary models that predict that the level of gravitational radiation could be quite small and very, very hard to see. So not seeing it does not rule out inflation, although certainly if it is seen, it would be very exciting, and I think it would, as Neil says, rule out versions of the theory that are like the one that he's talking about.
Let's take a call from Saratoga Springs, New York. Gwen, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm questioning the timeline. Is this going to happen in our lifetime, Big Bang?
Mm-hmm.
And does anything that we're doing here on planet Earth, does that radiate out into the universe? I mean, are we affecting this change to come into happening or what?
Neil?
No, it's certainly not going to happen in our lifetime. And if it happens at all, it would be in many tens of billions of years. There would be a lot of indications that it would be about to happen, because as these two brains approach, the masses and charges of particles would change, the strength of gravity would change, and the bang itself is a really amazing event in which all particles become massless. Everything sort of breaks apart into its elemental constituents. And so it would be an extremely obvious event that this was approaching. And we do not need to worry about it now.
And this is on a much greater scale than anything we affect. I mean, we're minute, yes, in this story.
Yes.
You know, Jan 11, as we have this conversation, I can't help but bear in mind that we've got opening this week in Kentucky the Creation Museum, which shows the biblical story of creation quite literally presented. You know, it was all happened 6,000 years ago in 7 days and so on. I mean, you know what the debate is in this country. How do you think this kind of debate among scientists that we're hearing this hour affects the public perception of science, confidence in science?
I should hope that it increases the confidence in science, because science is about debate. It's not about belief. So as Neil said, his belief is not significant in this. I mean, he might have an idea, but he shouldn't go to his grave clinging to this idea despite all evidence to the contrary. Science is about first a good idea, sure, but then mathematical consistency, and then finally experimental evidence. And so scientific debate is exactly what the whole premise is based on. That we bring ideas to the table, we argue them out, and we all can admit when we're wrong, and we can all agree on the observations. And that's extremely different than a faith-based approach, which says really quite the opposite, to accept the faith-based approach without arguing laboriously and diligently about the evidence and without being willing to abandon it. If it turns out that these gravitational wave signals are definitive, then I think we will all agree. Everyone here will come to the same conclusion. And that's what impresses me so much about working in the scientific community. And that's, I hope, what people will walk away understanding.
But Neil, you've written that this does intersect with the realms of faith. I mean, Hinduism has a kind of model that sort of lines up more with yours, this endless repetition of epochs and eras, whereas, let's say, Christianity, you know, this sort of creation moment or handful of days is more important. It kind of jibes better with the poetry, at least, of the Big Bang. Do you see your research shaking or intersecting or shaping faith?
I hope not. No, I don't think it has anything to do with faith. I think different peoples at different times have had all kinds of imaginative ideas about the universe, and I think those are very beautiful ideas and wonderful conceptions. And when we are now trying to turn the sort of mental pictures we have into scientific theories, testable scientific theories, many of those ideas may be inspiring and helpful in that way, but they're not science. And I certainly don't think the fact that the Hindus believed in cycles of creation lends any credence to our theory. It doesn't help our theory at all.
It just sits there, but it is there, certainly. Yeah. And you know, we lay people always look for these resonances. Alan Guth, we don't know how this is going to turn out. Maybe we won't in our lifetime. I don't know. But where does it leave you? How does it leave you feeling as the inflationary guy? You know, now you're saddled with the poetry of, well, in your view, it all comes to some sort of dark, empty end. Does that matter to a scientist, the poetry associated with that, or is it just about the math in the end for you?
Well, I think we're aware of the poetry. I don't think any of us would think that we should be guided by that poetry. I think that's really what Neil was just saying as well. These theories do make predictions for the ultimate fate of our universe, certainly at periods that are long after we'll all be dead.
Of course.
So they don't really affect our own lives directly. But they do affect our view of humanity and the purpose of life and the purpose of the universe. I think as physicists, it's our job to weigh the evidence, weigh the observations, build mathematical theories to account for it, and let the ships fall where they may as far as what implications these ideas might have for philosophy.
Wow, well, what a tremendous glimpse for all of us who don't follow it all the time. Maybe those little images in the textbooks will have to change one day soon. We'll find out. Neil Turok, thank you for your work. Thank you for your book, Endless Universe Beyond the Big Bang. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And Alan Guth of MIT, wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jana Levin at Barnard College. Jana, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.